everyone, and welcome to Myth Matters, a bi-weekly podcast of storytelling and conversation about mythology and why it's important to our lives today. I'm your host and personal mythologist, Catherine Svela. Thank you so much for joining me. Wherever you may be in this wide, beautiful, crazy world of ours, you are part of this story circle. I ended the last podcast on the Conference of the Birds with the question in my mind about how to have a living practice, how to move the spiritual out of that compartment or ghetto that we sometimes put it into and into daily life, how to make it an ongoing search for expression and gesture that is needed, available, and satisfying. This is a real ongoing question and project for me. And of course, it goes along with the question of how mythology and our identified myths, that is, the old stories that I share on this program, the classics and the religions and the fairy tales, can help us do this. Well, I've got a particularly rich story to share with you today, one that I'm finding a lot of wisdom and teaching in, and I hope that it will provide some value for you too. It's called The Queen Bee, and I'm going to share my version of it, which is based on the story as it was collected by the Brothers Grimm. So I invite you to sit back and relax and let the story take you where you need to go right now. Note the moments or the details that catch your attention, maybe something that puzzles or delights or infuriates you. Whatever it is, this is an opening into the meaning this story holds for you right now. The Queen Bee. Once upon a time, two sons of a king left home to seek adventure. They fell into a wild and reckless way of living and gave up all thoughts of going home. Their third and youngest brother, who was called Witling, had remained behind, but after a time, he went off to look for them. And when at last he found them, they jeered at his simplicity and told him that he was a total fool for thinking that he could make his way in the world, while they, who were so much cleverer, had been unsuccessful. Reunited, the three of them went on together. And after a time, they came to an anthill. The two eldest brothers picked up sticks. They wanted to stir up the anthill so they could watch the poor little ants hurry about in fear, carrying off their eggs. But Witling said, "Leave the little creatures alone. I will not suffer them to be disturbed." The three brothers went on a little further until they came to a lake. A number of ducks were swimming about, and the two eldest brothers wanted to catch a couple of the ducks and cook them. But Witling would not allow it. He said, "Leave the creatures alone. I will not suffer them to be killed." So the three of them traveled on, and then they came to a bee's nest in a tree. There was so much honey in it that it overflowed and ran down the trunk in a sticky golden stream. The two oldest brothers wanted to make a fire under the tree to stifle the bees with the smoke. Then they could get at the honey. But Witling prevented them and said, "Leave the little creatures alone. I will not suffer them to be stifled." The two oldest brothers were not happy with this, but despite their grumbling, the three of them continued on until they came to a castle. All was quiet. They peered into the stables, and they found many horses standing stock still. The horses were made of stone. Now the brothers went through all of the quiet rooms, each of them devoid of life, until they came to a door at the end of a long hallway. The door was secured with three locks, and in the middle of the door, there was a small opening through which they could look into the room. And they peered in and saw a little gray-haired man sitting at a table. And he was alive. "Hey," they called out to him, "come and let us in." But he didn't hear them. They called out to him again. And he still sat at his table, unaware. But the third time that they called out to him, he got up, undid the locks on the doors, and came out. He didn't say a word. He just led them to a table loaded with all sorts of good things. And when they had eaten and drunk, he showed the three brothers to his bedchamber. And there they each found a bed. Well, the next morning, the little gray-haired man came to the eldest brother and beckoned him over to a table of stone. Carved into this table were instructions for releasing the castle from its enchantment. And there were three tasks to be completed. The first task was to go into the surrounding woods and search under the moss for the pearls that belonged to the princesses. There were 1,000 of these pearls, and they needed to be found and collected. And whoever undertook this task had to find all 1,000 and complete this by sunset. Because if even one pearl was missing, he would be turned to stone. So the oldest brother went out and he searched all day. He looked and he looked, but at sunset he had only found 100 pearls, and the inscription in that table of stone came to pass. He was turned into stone. The second brother undertook this adventure the next day, but he didn't fare any better than his older brother. He did find 200 pearls, but it was only 200 pearls, and he was also turned into stone. Now it was Whitling's turn. He began to search in the moss, but it was a very tedious business to find the pearls. And he was very slow and clumsy at it. And before long, he was despondent. He was bored by the task and frustrated and frightened at the prospect of failure. So he sat down on a stone and he began to weep. He was sitting there with his hands over his face when up from the ground came the Ant King with 5,000 ants, ants whose lives had been saved through Whitling's pity. It didn't take the ants long to collect all of the 1,000 pearls and put them in a heap at Whitling's feet. Now, the second task carved into the table of stone was to get the key to the princess's sleeping chamber out of the lake. Whitling went down to the shore of the lake without any idea of how to begin. But the ducks, whose lives he had saved, came swimming up. They dived below the surface, and before long they found the key and brought it up to him from the muddy bottom of the lake. The third task that had to be done was the most difficult. In one of the rooms, there lay three princesses, all deep asleep, deep in an enchanted sleep. Wilting had to choose the youngest and the loveliest of the three. But the problem is, they all bore a perfect resemblance to each other. They all looked the same. The only difference was this. Before they had gone to sleep, each one had eaten a different sweetmeat. The eldest had eaten a piece of sugar. The second had eaten a little syrup. The third and youngest had eaten a spoonful of honey. Witling gazed at the three still faces. He was standing there by the three beds when the queen bee flew into the room. She was the queen of those bees that Witling had protected from the fire. One by one, the queen tasted the lips of each princess and settled on those of the one that had eaten honey. Now the king's son knew which princess to choose. And so the spell was broken. Everyone awoke from their stony sleep and took their right form again. The horses and servants, the royal family, the two eldest brothers. Witling married the youngest and loveliest princess, and he became king after her father's death. As for the two brothers, well, they had to put up with the other two sisters. And that's the end of the story. This story contains many powerful and interesting images. There's a lot of metaphors that you can investigate for their symbolic meanings. And it's a superficially simple and rather short story, and yet there's a mind-boggling number of possibilities conveyed here. I encourage you to investigate these characters, the ants, the ducks, the bees, the pearls, the horses, whatever calls to you. Let it matter. Give it your attention and see what happens. For now, I want to step back from those specifics and take a bigger view of the story as a whole in order to consider what it could be about. I'm also going to share some thoughts about my moment in the story, which was something that really, really bugged me at first. Now, being annoyed by a detail in a story and going into it, reflecting on it, can be very fruitful. Don't simply dismiss this and fall back on some preconceived judgments. Get curious. I share some of my experience with the story because I hope that what I glean will resonate with you. And also, to help you do this kind of work with the story yourself. Okay. Now, Mary Louise von Franz suggests that if you want to unpack the larger themes of a fairy tale, you begin by noticing the opening situation. This is a useful bit of advice, okay? It's not mandatory, of course. But in this story, the Queen Bee, we have three brothers, three young men, the sons of kings. The king himself isn't present, and there are no women and no elders of any gender. So these point to the missing ingredients in the situation, and the story is going to tell us something about this and perhaps resolve it. What are the missing ingredients? Maturity. There's a need for a new order and revitalization. We've got the feminine, that is feeling a new life, that's gone. Somehow, the different pieces that we need to have a functioning kingdom are tied up with this notion of of the wisdom of the elders and the feminine and the maturation of these sons. And one clue to this is the fact that there isn't actually a kingdom at the beginning. The sons of the king have left home. And then later on in the story, the castle that they find is inert. It's lifeless. It's waiting for the breath of life. It's stone, all except for that little old man. And this kingdom, as we know, is an inner and an outer situation, just as this masculine-feminine is an inner and an outer situation. And I do find myself in these days wondering how a country of immature people, people who operate like the two eldest brothers, are ever going to create a functioning kingdom. Okay, now if you look into the meanings that are attached to the various players in this story, you're going to find that there are many associations to the goddess, to Earth as mother, and to what we now call the feminine. It's not just the absence of a princess. The ducks, for example, are an ancient face of the mother goddess. In the podcast on Aphrodite and Eros, that was earlier this year, I believe that I mentioned the myth of the great mother who was hatched from an egg that was found in the water, rolled onto shore, and then brooded by birds until it was her time to emerge. In the Middle East in particular, there are a lot of images of the early goddess in the form of aquatic birds. In Greek mythology, ducks are connected to Penelope, the wife of Odysseus. Penelope, who spent the long years of his absence in her own incubation, weaving and then unraveling her work, and in this process becoming someone new. The name Penelope comes from the Greek word for duck. When Penelope was born, her father, Icarus, was very disappointed and angry. He wanted a son, and when he discovered the infant girl, he threw her into the ocean to drown. A family of ducks rescued her, and her father changed his tune. He recognized this as an omen of her specialness. And I find it interesting that the ducks in this fairy tale also rescue something of value from the water, a feminine principle from the unconscious, as a Jungian might say. So we need to have we need to find the missing feminine in order for this new order, for this living kingdom to come about. And in this story, we have this male protagonist, Witling, but he isn't the typical hero, is he? This isn't really a hero's journey in the way that we normally think of it. I mean, Witling doesn't seem to have any ambition to be great or mighty or successful. He's more of a caretaker. He's gentle. When he grasps the futility of his search for the pearls, he gives up and weeps like Psyche in the ancient myth of Psyche and Eros. If you know that story, you remember that Psyche is given the impossible task of sorting a huge pile of seeds in a day. And when she surrenders to the impossibility of this and sits down to cry, ants appear to do the task for her. When I tell this story, the fact that Psyche sits down and cries often annoys people. Annoys them because they think that she should be doing something else, that she should be tougher, stronger, and somehow, you know, pull some sort of solution out of thin air. And I think that's part of the narrowness of our just constant hammering away on this narrow view of the heroic. Because although crying isn't part of this heroic playbook, it is a reasonable and honest response to an impossible situation. To know what you can't do, and to not only admit it to yourself, but to feel the reality of it. This is a genuine appreciation of self and situation, isn't it? And what's interesting is that when you're in that state, help arrives from unexpected quarters. That this help is unexpected is very important to note. Is when we're talking about just sitting down, giving up, and weeping, we're talking about surrender. And surrendering to impossible situations means that you really don't have any place to turn and no expectation of success. I often talk with people about difficult situations or difficult decisions that they face. And the underlying despair in being boxed in feeling like there maybe are no options, that there is no way out, gets choked off with sentiments like, oh, I know that everything will work out for the best, or oh, prayers are answered, or oh, I have faith in this, that, or the other thing. And there's nothing wrong with this. And I understand it. In many situations, I think it's exactly the right strategy. But this isn't surrender. This isn't a state of no expectations, of no sense of capability. When you place your faith in something that you think might still bring you what you want, as you've imagined it, you haven't surrendered. Surrender happens when you accept failure, when you move into the place and space of failure and the consequences of it. And here something miraculous occurs, something unexpected. Now, how this happens, that it happens, is a mystery. And yet, there is a connection, I think, between honest awareness, a sense of one's own abilities and limitations, feeling, and character. Wilting is a different type of person, isn't he, than his older brothers? He has different values. He has a different sensibility, and so a different image of himself. Wilting doesn't see the ants and pick up a stick and go, oh, hey, great, let's terrorize these little insects. Now, as part of the formal academic study of fairy tales, the stories are cataloged according to motif indexes. In the Arne Thompson Index, which is one of the two commonly employed, this story, The Queen Bee, is cataloged under the heading Supernatural Helpers and the subheading Grateful Animals, which is cross-referenced with another group, Tales of Magic. Now, parenthetically, the Grateful Dead got their band name by opening one of these folklore motif indexes at random and, boom, putting their finger down on the motif heading Grateful Dead. Anyway, I think this motif title is interesting, and it's a way into what I see as the backdrop of this story. I don't much care for this notion of grateful animal, although I understand the concept, and I'm sure that you do too. The two older brothers want to kill the ants, the ducks, the bees. The youngest intervenes on their behalf, so when he needs help, they've got his back, they show up for him. Yes, they are grateful, But doesn't it feel a little backwards to focus on their response rather than Whitling's actions and attitude? Couldn't this motif be named recognizing reciprocity, for example? I think the fact that we don't categorize this story by some name like recognizing reciprocity shows us the assumptions that's part of the shadow of this Christian myth of human and particularly male superiority. This unfounded idea we've got that only human beings possess intelligence, emotion, and soul. That we live in a world that where only human beings count. And as such, then, if something like an ant responds to us, oh my goodness, that's magic, rather than recognition from sentient beings of a like-minded appreciation for the gift of life. We have created a culture of power, and I think what we need is a culture in service to life. And what I'm suggesting is that Whitling is of that sensibility. And so, yes, he is rewarded. The truth that I see is this reciprocity between beings, fellow creatures, that lends order to a community of sentient others in an animate world. Now, do you think that there are so many stories and so many myths around the world woven into human cultures about this kind of partnership between humans and our fellow creatures, because human beings from the earliest days of recorded history have wished and longed for such a relationship? Or is it possible, do you think, or even likely, that we have such a plethora of these stories because they contain a literal truth and possibility? Are the shamans and the seekers who consult their animal guides all nuts? Are all of the animal communicators out there frauds? Am I crazy to experiment with my awareness of the intelligence that surrounds me? To speak, to listen, to respond? Well, I'll answer the last question for you. No, I'm not. I'm not crazy. There are so many beautiful and profound possibilities in the old stories, and so many opportunities to learn, to expand your consciousness and your sense of self, to break out of this sad conditioning of modern Western culture and test the assumptions and the half-baked theories, like this notion that we are the only intelligent beings on this planet Earth, with your own experience, against your value system. It's exciting. It's also a lot of work. It's easier, it's more convenient to let someone else be the authority, to go along, safer maybe. Or is it safer these days? I don't know. In any event, it's a waste of your life, the gift of this life. Whatever you think about intraspecies communication, you do sense, don't you, the beautiful symmetry in this story, in the notion that proper union between the masculine and the feminine, the realization of a whole human being in place, embodied in a material world, is a person who is also in harmony with the rest of nature. People use the phrase right relation, meaning to be in right relationship to everything and everyone. And that phrase is part of a spiritual path. Today, this insight is associated with indigenous cultures. And in my case, I initially learned this from exposure to Native American teachings. And yet, we all have indigenous roots in some part of the world. And even the great machine of the West, powered by these twin engines of Christian dogma and scientism, well, maybe it's not as monolithic or disconnected as we are taught to believe. This spiritual instruction, be in right relationship, this view of the world as a diverse community of beings with inherent value and right to life, isn't that the context for this story? What prevents this exploration, this openness to this adventure in your life, do you think? There might be a lot of answers to that question. If there is indeed a singular path for each one of us in this life, that was one of the messages in the last podcast from the Conference of the Birds, that each of us is making a journey that no one else really can duplicate or understand. That said, one obstacle that I see and experience in my life, one obstacle to being open to this possibility, that there is a recognition of reciprocity, not only in whittling, but also in the bees and the ducks and the ants, is this often unconscious habit of overestimating yourself, overestimating your knowledge, your skill, your power, and your value in the grand scheme of things. We are schooled in this, my friends. And in the story, we've got the two older brothers. They believe that they're clever. They disparage their younger brother, presumably because they think he is, like, you know, soft and sensitive and dreamy and God knows what, you know what I mean? He certainly isn't clever. They believe that they had the right to terrorize the ants, kill the ducks, rob the bees. They don't have any respect. And you know, did you notice that the actions were not motivated by need? They didn't say, oh, we've been traveling for days and days without eating and we're hungry, so let's kill a duck. It's more like, oh, what do you do with ducks? Oh, you kill a couple. This sense that I will destroy, disturb, and rob because I can. That power dynamic again. Power that's not in service to life. There's a tremendous insecurity in this hubris, my friends. Where is your root if you live cut off from nature, and therefore then cut off from your own nature? If you live trying to compensate for this lack of wholeness and humanity through other satisfactions, numbness, overwork, and denial of the inevitable, that is the natural cycles, and especially the natural cycle of growth, maturation, aging, and death. I said I would tell you about my moment in the story. Okay, I still don't, even this time when I told this story, the ending words that the two brothers had to put up with the other two sisters. As far as I was concerned when I first came across the story, I thought, you know, well, the sisters got the booby prize with these two callous brothers as husbands. And yet, I thought about it, and I realized, oh, this all fits. Because we're not all equal in awareness and maturity and wisdom, men or women, both. We're all on this quest for the proper relationship between masculine and feminine. Both genders, we all need to bring these things into balance. And I would go so far as to say that even this idea that somehow women have the feminine under control and they just need to get in relationship to the masculine and vice versa is wrong. We are so out of whack. We're all in need of this inner marriage, whether we know it or not. We need the harmonious expression of this union in the psyche, in the personality. And so then, in life. Well, so my dislike then of the words sent me back to the story in consideration of the differences between the three sisters. So the brothers are different. The two brothers think they're clever and they want to wreck things. And Whittling is sensitive and kind, I would say, has this respect for the lives of others. Well, so what are the differences between the three sisters? Whittling, the youngest brother, must identify the youngest and loveliest of the three sisters. Maybe you bridle at this loveliest and youngest business, and yet we are talking about the intermarriage between the youngest. You know, there's this sense of the youngest marrying the youngest. This is about new life, about turning what was stone into flesh again. And there's a fantastic clue in this story to the deeper significance of these qualities, namely that Witling can't tell which of the sisters is the youngest and the loveliest by looking at them. Outwardly, they look the same. This isn't a measure of outer qualities, of the surface and surface meaning. The youth and beauty point to qualities of soul, of spirit, of character, to the innocence and the vitality, the kindness and the wisdom. They point to the need for Witling to find his feminine counterpoint. And how is this young woman going to be identified? Each of them ate something sweet, and the queen bee finds the one who ate the honey. So what's different is the sweetness on their lips. And the one who ate the honey, she's the one. Now, the queen bee, like other characters in this story, has a long mythological connection to the mother goddess, to fertility, abundance, the life force. Honey is liquid gold, solidified sunlight, ambrosia, the food of the gods. And as the producers of this glorious substance, bees were linked by the Greeks to the muse, to poetic inspiration, and the oracles. The priestess at the Oracle of Delphi, which has been in a couple of the podcasts that I've created recently, the priestess at that Oracle of Delphi was called the Delphic Bee. Honey, what a substance. It is the key ingredient in mead. It was often added to wine and beer, to soma, to balke, to mention only a few of the known beverages that have been utilized over the centuries for recreation and also for more serious pursuit of states of altered consciousness. And what about the evocation of paradise in the phrase milk and honey? The great gift of these two different and complementary life-sustaining substances is appreciated, revered, or was, in every culture that produced both. Honey is a healer, the basis of ointments and salves, and honey was used to preserve the body after death. So much inspiration, so much food found in this simple fairy tale. You know, a queen bee is not a tyrant. She is selected and created by the group, and she serves them as they serve her. Bees are rightfully honored by those who live in right relationship with awareness of this reciprocity for their industriousness and efficiency and cleanliness. As pollinators and as food sources for other insects and birds, bees are one of the most important beings in the food chain. Their well-being and survival is essential to ours and to the continuation of most of the life on Earth as we know it. There is, again, this melding of material and metaphorical truth, what is often called fact and fiction. And that is the power and gift of these old stories, my friends. Metaphor and information. This has been just a terrible, terrible week in the United States, a terrible week after many other terrible weeks, a time of rage and weeping. But there's one more lesson that I want to share with you that I've gleaned from the bees. And it's a poem that I found in Orion magazine by Tess Taylor, titled, On Not Posting the Bees to Instagram. Impossible to photograph the bees in the lavender. Even trying too soon felt ridiculous. They were so busy, so out of focus, that I put down the camera and let myself linger, realizing as I did the sheer pleasure of hearing their thrum in the blossoms, of glimpsing their dizzy gold-on-purple bodies weaving summer's brocade, a diadem buzzing pollen and light. I have no photo. Perhaps you will ponder this note instead. I did want to celebrate the bees and their loudness. I did want to broadcast my joy. Joy, my friends, this is our challenge and our task in these times. And that's it for me, Catherine Savela and Myth Matters. Feel free to contact me if you have questions or comments about today's program. If you are new to Myth Matters, I invite you to head over to the Mythic Mojo website, where you will find information about Myth Matters and a variety of ways to subscribe to this podcast. You can listen to it from a variety of platforms like iTunes, Google Play, etc. I'm very grateful to all of you who support this program by sharing it with other people and spreading the word about what we're doing here at Myth Matters. And I am deeply, doubly grateful to those of you who are able to provide some financial support to this podcast. Special thanks this week to Julia Earhart and Lauren Volstick for joining the Myth Matters community on Bandcamp. Thank you so much for listening. Please tune in next time. And until then, happy myth making, and keep the mystery in your life.